Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There's a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. We know that running a small firm is tough, and ending the year with a profit may be even tougher. That's why we created Profit for Small Firm Architects. It's a 3-module digital course, and it's available to you for free right now by visiting entrearchitect.com/freecourse. Entree Architect Podcast, episode 130. Welcome back to the Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and this is the podcast dedicated to a successful life as a small firm architect. Whether you have plans to someday start your own firm, whether you're in the process of launching a startup, or you might be an experienced small firm architect just trying to make a difference, this podcast is for you. My goal is to inspire you to build a better business so that you may pursue your purpose with passion and live the life of your dreams. In this episode, our first of the month of July 2016, we're shifting our focus away from technology, the topic that we've been focused on all month long in June. So if you're interested in technology and how it can affect your business and how to succeed in business using technology, go back to the episodes all through June of 2016, because the next business focus in July of 2016 is management. So how do we build and run a successful business? How do we build the right systems? How do we build the right team? How do we efficiently and effectively do what we do as architects in the most profitable way? That is what we're going to be talking about all month long here on the podcast and everywhere else on the Entree Architect platform, on the blog, on the newsletter, all through social media. We're going to be talking about management. And this week, I invited a young architect from Boston to join me here on the podcast because he has a very interesting story to share. While attending architecture school in Boston, he took a position with a local design build firm and found himself unexpectedly the owner of that firm just 3 years later. We spoke about how he focused on the firm's brand, how he restructured the company as an employee-owned cooperative, how he offered services exclusively based on passive house and sustainable practice, how he launched into design and real estate development, and how he plans to take his firm to national recognition. This week at Entree Architect Podcast, I'm speaking with architect Declan Keefe of Place Taylor about how to build a successful architecture firm that works. This episode of the Entree Architect Podcast is sponsored by FreshBooks, the easiest way to send invoices, manage expenses, and track your time. Learn more at freshbooks.com/architect. Declan Keefe, welcome to the Entree Architect Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great having you here. One of our mutual friends, Marilyn Modinger, introduced us. Marilyn's a member of Entree Architect as well as a facilitator. She's been very involved in what we're doing over there. And I put out a call for interesting people in architecture, and your name immediately was responded to by Marilyn and said, we need to connect. So welcome to the show, and I'm glad you're here.
I'll try to live up to Marilyn's comments.
I'm sure you will. Most episodes, I'd love to start with your origin story. Talk about when you discovered architecture and why you decided to take this journey to become an architect. Talk about that journey and talk a little bit about what you do today.
Sure. So I definitely didn't have the I grew up wanting to be an architect story. I was actually focused on photography largely, and ended up going to the Boston School of Fine Arts for photography. And I did about a year there and realized that I didn't want to do the fine arts life. I didn't want that struggle, and I didn't really like the idea that you could be as competent, proficient, and even amazingly creative and still just be at the whims of the artistic world, which is unpredictable. And so it was really from there I thought, you know, well, what can mix the creative passion that I have with the fine arts and also the maths and the sciences that I felt like I was missing out of just to sort of keep a well-rounded life and career path. And so it was really there where I stumbled upon the idea of architecture. And at the time, I had sort of expanded beyond my photography, and I was doing sculpture and film and just about, you know, any class I could take. I was like doubling my course load at the fine arts school. And I started to think about the idea of architecture as large-scale occupiable sculpture. And that was more of a way to convince myself that it was okay to transition from fine arts into architecture, and not that I was copping out of my creative path. And so then I went down the architecture path. And
how far into the fine arts path were you before you made that transition?
So I just did a year and a half at the Boston School of Fine Arts, and it was a great transition. And it turned out I sort of immediately fell in love with the architecture education, but even more so, I went to the Boston Architectural College, and my first year I did just academics. They have a system that's set up where you can do academics only, but then that school transitions where you work while you're in school. And that was really when it sort of took off for me, is when I started to work. And I was actually looking to find a job in construction first. I've got a long list of relatives who are in construction who sort of do the traditional poo-pooing of the architecture profession. And I was going to show them that there's a way to do both, which actually plays in very much to my longer-term story. What ended up happening was I didn't find a job in construction. I found a job with this newly formed company at the time called Place Taylor. And Place Taylor was essentially trying to buck the trend and say, we're going to do both architecture and construction together. And it's not just going to be that we have an architecture company and we have a construction company and they talk to each other, but rather that everyone in the team is going to both be a designer and a builder. And so you have to, in order to be part of the team, you have to come in with sort of the understanding and the, you know, some base skill set of being able to do both.
And how long was Place Taylor around when you started working there?
It wasn't around at all. I was not one of the founders, though I was a founding employee. So one of the first five that was hired, and started from essentially day one.
So you were hired to start the firm.
Hired, starting firm.
Okay. So and it was a startup.
It was a startup. Technically, it was founded in January of 2008. We didn't really start doing work until June of 2008. And so there was 6 months where nothing really happened except Simon Hare, who was the founder. He, you know, created a basic website and did some branding and bought a piece of land, which would be his house, which would start the company, as many architecture firms have started. And so I was by far the least experienced and skilled on the team, and I, which resulted in, you know, me being a laborer largely, both in the architecture, drawing up details, as well as labor in the field, literally.
And that was first year in school?
So I had finished my first year. This was sort of at the beginning of my second year in school. Yeah. I started up with this company. And that's really the launch of sort of the beginning of where my career is still. I'm still with Place Taylor. And
currently an owner.
Currently an owner. So it actually progressed very quickly. I was very excited about the work I was doing, and committed both in my academics and in my career, sort of every waking hour, to growing the skills I needed to, because I felt like I was given an opportunity within this business. And essentially 2 years in, I was a project manager leading projects. And then 3 years in, extenuating circumstances, Simon, who founded the business, let us all know that he would be leaving. And the question went out, is this business going to keep going? And if so, who would take over?
That's so, 3.5 years into it.
Essentially, yeah, right around there. And and we had just really started picking up steam. We got some great press right off the bat with our first projects, which sort of kept us going for a little while. But it was there were some ups and downs for sure. And ultimately, I was still in the midst of my schooling, and I said, yeah. So I took over the business. I was the sole owner at the time. We did about a 9 month or so transition between Simon and myself, to which I then was set free to run my own business.
What year was that? How long ago was that?
So that was about 3 years ago or so now.
Yeah. Okay.
And so now I went, you know, fairly quickly from not knowing anything to needing to know how to run the ins and outs of the business, both on the architecture side and the construction side. And simultaneously, sort of two major things were happening when I took over the business. I made a commitment to the larger team that said that if I were to take over, I want to transition the business into an employee-owned cooperative.
How big was the team at the time?
So the folks who had been with us long enough to even be considering whether there would be ownership or not, there was four of them, but the larger team, including some folks at the time who were just on the carpentry side, I think we were probably 10 or 12 people at that time. So not necessarily a small operation
right.
to just take on my side, on the side of finishing up my schooling.
Yeah. What an opportunity, though. I mean,
but an amazing opportunity yeah. that I felt like I couldn't turn down, partly for my own sake, but also partly for the sake of the business. The fact that we were really testing the boundaries of where architecture and construction meet felt important for the industry, especially here in Boston. And what it allowed us to do was to test the boundaries of high performance and energy efficient buildings. And that was where a lot of our attention and press was coming from, is we were pretty early adopters of the Passive House standard, and we were just doing it. We weren't holding back, and no one was going to tell us we couldn't do it, even though everyone was freaking out that it was too expensive or too complicated. It was, you know, we controlled enough of the pieces, being the designer and the builder, that we could make our clients comfortable that it was possible. And then the second transition that I was mentioning when I took over was to start doing real estate development, at which point we now controlled a lot of the process. We were the client, we were the architect, and we were the builder. And so that was our first development project was happening in the midst of the transition from Simon to myself. And then we've continued on since, running essentially full speed in our our architecture, construction, and real estate development companies. Part of the sort of strange process that I went through resulted in the fact that I'm actually not a licensed architect, and have essentially worked almost no hours under a licensed architect. And so I couldn't get my license if I wanted to right now because I haven't worked those hours. There's no one to sign off because I'm the guy who would sign off for it right, currently.
Right.
Though it is the case that we have had a licensed architect in-house now for about a year, and we've made that transition as we want to expand the business to focus on potentially larger scale architecture, which is a limiting factor for the design build world. And that's something that we realized is to scale up architecture doesn't take a significantly larger staff. To scale up construction takes a very different company to start to scale. And so currently we don't feel like we want to scale our construction arm to match the way in which we want to scale on the architecture arm. And so there's some transitions there, one of which was it being very important that we now have a licensed architect because we're not just doing the 1 to 3 families anymore. We're making our way into larger buildings. So.
Now, are you doing client services as well on the architecture side?
We do. We do client services mixed in with our development work. It's not as often that we're doing client work that just ends at the architecture. Often it results in them wanting us to build it.
Right.
Though that's another reason that we're trying to grow the architecture arm of the business is that we could take on work that isn't just local anymore. We can expand geographically, at which point we would more likely be doing more and more just architecture and not expanding into the build. Though we're actually working with another business called Homebuilt, which is sort of a CNC-based kit home company. And we're trying to collaborate with them such that we potentially have a way of doing architecture in slightly wider geographic location for a client and reduce the construction costs through some of the innovations that Homebuilt's working on and have a faster construction phase somewhere else. So we might be able to, for example, go into some place in northern Maine where I'm not going to send my whole crew 4 hours away, but I could send a project manager for 2 months maybe and find a local crew to assemble a kit, and it's still our design. So things like that, we're working to innovate so that we can expand. And those are largely based on we're expanding the architecture company purposefully instead of just having it be haphazard or working backwards from getting construction. And then we have some architecture. Though currently and in the coming year, a lot of our work is specifically coming out of our real estate development. And I think that largely has to do with the fact that just the Boston real estate market is still doing well, and we're trying to capitalize on that while we can.
So the architecture side, you want to scale, but scaling that means to basically get more work. You can do a lot more work with the same amount of people. You'll eventually have to hire some more people.
Sure.
But not like the side of the construction side. So to scale the construction side, you actually have to have people building. And so in order to have more construction projects, you have to have more people. And so that gets, you know, huge overhead, big company.
Right.
And that's something you don't want to do, right? And so you're looking for a way to continue to grow nationally without having to grow a giant company. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, that's definitely right.
Okay. And so you're doing that by doing development, because development, you can control the process, but not necessarily be the one that's doing the construction work yourself. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's one of the reasons that we're doing development work. Another is what I mentioned, just that we have control such that we can sort of test different things in the market. So all of our development projects are at least meeting the passive house standard, and most of them now are being designed to be zero net energy or positive energy at the end of the project. Now, some of that relies on whether the client puts solar in and all sorts of other questions, because it makes sense for them to capitalize that, not us. But we're compared to other developers who we have collaborated with in the past, it's become very apparent to us that unless your mindset is that you want to be testing these things, you're not going to, because you have to convince a whole lot of people that it's a good idea, even if you already believe it. And so it's just easier to have the architect, the builder, and the developer all on the same page already, because there's still a lot of people to convince even once they're already on board.
Right. So you can do development. You could do it like a case study where you design and build these, show your market that it can work, have exactly. a model to show an example of it, and why it's beneficial, and then be able to more easily convince the architecture side, the client services side, that this is the way it should be done.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
When you're talking about Passive House, are you promoting that and marketing that as an additional piece, as an option, or is it just the way PlaceTailor does work? And this is, when you work with us, this is how it's built. Which way are you approaching that?
Oh, that's just the way we do it. We won't do anything less than that.
Okay.
Essentially since the company started, and this is kind of a funny thing for me, but I've never built a standard construction house in my career. We've only done high performance houses, which is great, but it's also sometimes can be tricky when people ask me to compare things to standard construction. I don't really have a good sense of how that goes. I mean, I do based off of understanding the industry, but I don't have the physical carpentry experience of having built something that way. And so it literally is, even in our contracts, it says, if you're hiring us, we will hit these standards. If you don't want to do that, you shouldn't hire us.
Right. Yeah. So that's part of your brand.
It's a very large part of our brand. I'd say there's really two things which we largely focus on in our brand. One is that we build high performance housing. We've been doing it for 9 years or so. And at least with Passive House, that's a pretty long time in this country. And the second being that we have integrated services. Even if you don't want to hire PlaceTailor for your construction or to do real estate development, it's still helpful to have the architect really understand the built environment and really understand its impact on the real estate development side. Even if it's just a homeowner who's not interested in real estate development, the number of times that I've found myself talking to a client and just giving them feedback on how the current investment they're making in the construction of their home affects the longer term real estate impacts for them in resale is a value that I can bring and our team can bring that you might not have otherwise if you're just focused on just the architecture piece of this larger industry or puzzle.
Yeah, I mean, your website looks great. It's clear. It's very well branded. Let's talk about brand a little bit more. Let's get deeper into that. How important is building the brand of PlaceTailor to accomplishing what you want to accomplish?
I think it's huge. I mean, it's been a large part of my focus for the last few years when I took over the business. We had a pretty good brand, actually, and that was part of what I was buying when I took over the business, was the fact that maybe not in the greater Boston world, but definitely within the high performance construction scene, we were known as sort of the innovator, scrappy guys in the urban setting who, you know, didn't really care what anyone said and we're going to make it happen.
And what you just said right there is a big part of your brand. Right?
It absolutely is.
And so when a lot of times, the reason I want to get into this is because people who are listening, sometimes when you hear brand, you think, okay, a logo or maybe even the way the website looks. But what you're talking about is what the perception people have of you, the story that you're telling people.
That storytelling goes back further into my sort of my history. I sort of grew up doing some storytelling and then have continued to, and actually as a performance style. And so it's become very rooted in all of the work that I do. And yeah, the brand itself, even the logo, needs to represent we're those guys who are just going to make it happen. And I think it does that. You know, the Place Taylor, the name itself is, mm-hmm. is I think, indicative of that. The fact that we do a little bit of the sort of bold branding with orange. We're a little bit snarky even in a lot of our commentary on our website. And it's clear that we're trying to keep up with the times, with the videos on the front of our website that are playful and fun. And we want the experience with Place Taylor to just be an enjoyable one. It is a very difficult thing for especially homeowner clients. Designing and building a house is a big step for them. And we want to make that fun. And part of what our brand is join the cool kids club. And to live in a passive house, to live in a modern design, to live in a beautiful neighborhood in the city, and to work with these cool guys is going to make your life better in the ways that you want it to be. And that's a hard thing to do, and you only get one shot at it in your life. And we don't feel like you should take it too seriously, but realize that it is a serious topic. And so that's the brand that we've worked on. And in terms of working on it, when I took over the business, I was still trying to pull off the model of working part-time in the field, part-time in the office. And that was just core to our mission. Everybody worked in the field. Everyone was swinging a hammer. And I love that. I mean, it was really sort of part of what got me up every day, is that I knew I could be switching back and forth between the different pieces of fun that were to be had. But it became really clear that we had to put our heads down and really get the business set up. Branding, we needed to get our books in order. We needed to have time tracking in place. We needed contracts worked out. And like, we were just too scrappy before we started to make this transition after I took over. And we created a great business with some intrigue, but we weren't really running a business yet. And so I sacrificed the field and put my head down in the office, actually doing very little design work myself, but largely this stuff that, you know, we're talking about here. How are people going to know who we are when they find us? And when we reach out to people, which is when we're leading the projects by doing real estate development, it's often they don't need to find us. I need to find them, and then they need to be convinced once they see us that this is a good idea.
Yeah, I love what you're talking about, because that is the message, the thing that you just said about how you had to sacrifice the thing you love in order to do the thing that you had to do in order for this business to thrive is a very, very important message. I talk about it in terms of profit, then art. Mm-hmm. It's something I say all the time, that you need to focus on building a business that's profitable, so then you can go create amazing works of architecture.
Yeah. And I'd add one to that, saying once I made that sort of shift in mindset from leaving the carpentry out of it, what I was able to do was apply some of that passion and craft and even creativity to the creation of the business itself. And this is largely how I talk about it, is the creative process that we learn as architects in making a building really can apply very directly to the creation of a business if you're willing to let it. And I think a lot of people let their fear of numbers and business get in the way of enjoying that process. And the truth is, some of my best days are spent 6 hours in front of a spreadsheet running our business budgeting, because it just sets up, what are we going to be able to do this year if we do this well? And it's exciting, because we do some exciting and fun things, like the fact that we get to budget in our in-house events, which are parties that we throw in when we're halfway through building a house and invite the whole community. Like, you don't just get that if you don't plan for it. You've got to budget it in, and as soon as you budget it in, now it's going to happen and you can run that piece of your business. And so it can be a fun process, actually. And it also can lead to, now this is 3 years since then, and I do get back in the field sometimes because that's what I want to do, and that's what we've decided as a team, and I've been able to help lead other people. I have an amazing team that I'm working with who can do all of the things that I have been doing, and so it's just a matter of us coordinating, and then I get in the field. So that's part of the fun of it.
Yeah, that's the then art part.
Exactly. Right. Sure.
You do get to do the art. You just have to be patient, and you have to take care of the things that you need to take care of in order to put the systems into place to build the brand, to build a strong team, to build the systems that you need. And then that'll all start working and it'll start humming and everybody will be doing what they're supposed to be doing. Then you can go back to doing what you love to do. Let's take a quick break here to say thank you to FreshBooks for their support as a platform sponsor of Entree Architect. Because as a platform sponsor, FreshBooks has provided funding and support for our overall mission here at Entree Architect. They recognize the need for small firms like us to build better businesses in order to be better architects. FreshBooks is the easy-to-use accounting software designed to help us small firm owners get organized, save time, and get paid faster. It takes care of invoicing, expense tracking, estimating, reporting, and it all happens out on the cloud, so you have access to your information from anywhere that you have access to the internet. And I use FreshBooks for my own small firm, Five Cat Studio, and my favorite feature of the FreshBooks software is sending my invoices by email and allowing my clients to pay by credit card. When FreshBooks says that you'll get paid faster, they're not kidding. With the convenience of clicking a button and paying by credit card, many of my clients pay now as soon as they receive their invoice. And for those clients who don't pay right away, FreshBooks automatically sends them a reminder of the balance due at an interval that I set. So once I send an invoice, I can go back to being an architect, and I don't need to chase down any of my clients. And Tim Lee of FreshBooks will show you how easy it is to send invoices by email on our exclusive video series Tim and I produced exclusively for the Entree Architect community. Check out this free video series at entrearchitect.com/freshbooksvideo. There's no catch. There's no email. It's completely free. Just go to entrearchitect.com/freshbooksvideo and you will get the videos right away. There's three of them. Shows you everything you need to know about getting started. And then go to freshbooks.com/architect and sign up for your free 30-day trial and give it a try. It's free. I suggest you just send one invoice and see what happens. That's how I got started. Just send one invoice to one client and see how it works. And when I did that and I got paid much faster than usual, I signed up for the rest of it and I set up my whole account in FreshBooks. FreshBooks.com/architect for your free 30-day trial. And be sure to enter Entree Architect into How Did You Hear About Us section.
It's a little bit more well-rounded, and we get to choose that as leaders in our businesses. And I'm now one owner of four as part of the cooperative, and all of the employees that we have are on a track to potentially become owners. And with the cooperative business model, it's a consensus-based business, so not every decision in the business is made on consensus, but the governance-based decisions are. So we approve budgets together and we sort of make the larger, are we going to continue to do development work kind of decisions? How are we expanding? Do we want to grow this or that? We make those all together. And one of them is, am I going to stay in the office full time? Right? Like, do we want that to be an expense now that we have a website that works for us that can be updated fairly easily and we have people who can do that work and it's not all landing on me now? What do I want to do with the time that doesn't need to be creating the business that has been filled in the last number of years?
When you decided to go employee owned, and that was your decision, right? That's what you said, that that when you, if part of taking over in that transition was that you're going to be employee owned, what were the steps that you had to take to do that? I mean, that's a pretty big transition, especially for somebody who only has 3 years experience right out of school. You're like, Okay, now what?
I was still in school, actually. I mean, yeah. For two of those years, right. I was still finishing up school.
So how did you know what to do?
You know, this is one lesson that I learned pretty early on is the power of the internet. No, and this is part of what's happening right now. In fact, of this podcast is there's resources, amazing resources out there. And in addition to the internet, there's amazing people who are also resources who are out there. And people love to help other people. And so in the process of deciding about the employee ownership, I can pin it to one specific trip that I took that is to visit South Mountain Company in Martha's Vineyard, who runs a architecture and construction business and now solar business out there and is an employee-owned cooperative. They've been around for 40 or so years, 30 or so employee owners. And I went out there and I saw the way in which their business is structured and the potential value in employee ownership. And I literally came home that night and I said, all right, I'll take over the business. And in taking over this business, I'm committing to us transitioning to an employee-owned cooperative. And so that was like the decision point. It was really based in inspiration. And I had done enough research then, you know, essentially my internet perusing of what is it actually going to take? And it certainly didn't happen right away. It took 2 years, actually, because it was not the thing that needed to be focused on. I needed to get the rest of the business going and keep projects running and get the next project. And frankly, it didn't matter whether we were a co-op or not. We were going to be running the business the same way. And that's why I decided to transition to a cooperative was we were saying we were running this business cooperatively and getting input from everybody. And that was from day one. It was very collaborative, which I think is partly why I was hired was because we're doing this together, doesn't matter that you don't have all of the skills yet because we can all help each other where we have weaknesses and strengths. And I happen to have strengths in coordinating people and dealing with teams and less in, at that time, in architecture and construction, which is quickly why I quickly became project manager because that's a largely amount dealing with people and coordinating teams. And so I ended up there. And then now as the strategic director, I'm not only dealing with people, but I'm connecting different teams. So I sort of am overseeing the architecture with the construction and the development pieces of it and all of that integration, which becomes, I think, holistically united when you look at it in the frame of the employee ownership. Now, not only are we in the day-to-day work working collaboratively, but we're actually committed to that enough to say that we will have equal profit share, we'll have equal vote, and we'll have a consensus-based employee business that is open to anyone that we hire into this business. We have a 3-year vesting period, so it means you have to commit to us for 3 years at least before you can come in as an owner. And that's tough. This is a very transient city, in the very least. People come here, they do their schooling, and they often leave. And in the carpentry world, it's even more transient. They're used to working places for 6 months at a time until the season ends, and then they go to the next job. And so the people who really want to be here are clearly committed to the business, and then we want to be committed to them. And we think employee ownership is a way of doing that.
Yeah, it's such a great model for that, to incentivize, you know, young architects and contractors to come in and work towards that opportunity to be an owner, so they don't just come in, they get tired, or when they do get tired of it, and it's frustrating and they're struggling at that moment where they would typically just pick up and go somewhere else because it got hard.
Right.
They look at the opportunity before them and they say, no, I'm going to push through this and stay with this because look at what's going to be happening at the end. And then once you are an owner, then you really have an incentive to build the business and stay and grow with this forever and never really go anywhere because now it's yours. It's part of something that you've designed and built and are part of. It's a great model.
And that's been exciting for us to see. Now that we have these four owners and a few others who are in conversation about are also coming on who have been here for 3 years, is what is the dreaming? Once you're in the ownership position, where do you want to see it go? And for a few of us, it's, you know, what is the next stage for Place Taylor? Where are we going? Because we are business builders, and we don't want to just maintain where we are. And it's not just about expanding the architecture arm, and that would be satisfying. It's what is the next thing we're going to test in this industry? Because Passive House is here. We've got it. People just need to pick it up because it's coming. And that's not what we need to be testing anymore. There's other things in the business model. That's not what we need to be testing. We've tested the employee ownership. There's all sorts of things that we've tested along the ways. And what's exciting now is what's the next round of things that we're going to be testing. And some of that is geographic boundaries. Some of it's sort of technological, this stuff that we're talking about. How do we build Git homes cheaper other places, getting costs down? And some of it for me, some of the work that I'm doing on the strategic side of the business is thinking about the system at even a larger scale. So we've talked about now we have a lot of control because we're doing development, architecture, and build, but what's the next layer out? For us, I'm thinking about material acquisition. So where do our materials actually come from, and should that be part of our business? All the way back to, and this has been exciting research for me to do, what happens if we actually own a piece of land where we do our own logging, and then we own our own mill where we do our own milling, and then we attach it to the CNC machine, and then we don't have to do any cutting on site? Like, let's actually zoom out and think about how our buildings go together. And I think it's the fact that our business looks at all of those things allows us to zoom in and out. From this morning, I was at a meeting where we were figuring out how to do the architectural detailing of the front deck on a two-family home that we're building. And then I can zoom out and at the end of the day be thinking about how systematically can we be approaching sustainability and regenerative design, in that logic, realizing that what might actually be best is for us to be doing our own sustainable forestry services in-house. And now that might take 10 or 20 years, yeah. And we maybe don't actually want to do it, but it's the kind of thinking that's fun to be had when you are an owner and you realize, all right, you can do that. We just have to all agree to do it, and we have to find the money, and those are things that we know how to do. And yeah. So that's just, it's been fun.
I love your blue sky thinking. I love that there's no limits. Once you have your own business and you're making the decisions, you literally have no limits. You can go where you want to go, or at least dream about going where you want to go.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I love the enthusiasm you have. When I want to remind the people who are listening that that's why focusing on the business and building a business that works is as much fun as designing architecture. Mm. That you can do that. You can design what your business becomes. And yeah. As long as you can focus on that and you develop it, it can become what you want it to become. What are some of the ways that you're making some of those decisions? So you have a team and you have multiple owners. How is that dream making happening? How are you doing that communication? And then how are you deciding on what happens and which ones are you going to go forward with?
So each decision is sort of handled in different ways, and we have the equivalent of a decision tree. So if it's a management-based decision, it doesn't necessarily have to come back to the cooperative. If it's a sort of a longer-term business strategy decision, it does have to come back to the actual co-owners. And in many cases, it's not just coming to the owners, because we feel like it's going to impact the whole company. So even if you're not an owner, we often want to get some sense of whether it's the direction that they would be interested in. So but really down to, you know, carpenters and laborers and everyone that is involved in the company. But the decision-making process is, so for some of these bigger dreaming sort of systems level thinking about the industry, the way it's currently set up is whoever wants to have this idea or dream has the idea or dream, and we as a co-op decide how much time we're willing to allot to it. Say, all right, it's good for you to spend an hour a week looking into new CNC technology, or this collaboration that we have with Homebuilt. We say, all right, we're budgeting in X amount of overhead so that me and one of our other employees can really dig into what the budget cost estimating would be comparatively to standard construction. with the realization that a lot of these ideas may just flop. But unless you test them, you're not going to know if it flops. And part of, and this ties back to the brand of PlaceTailor wants to be the brand that's trying things first. And so if we wait till someone else has done it, we already aren't following our brand. And so we have to invest in doing these things that maybe seem crazy or even just bad ideas, because that's who we are. And that we get work because we are who we are, which means that it's not just an empty investment in something. It's actually when we say we're going to work on testing the next boundary of whatever it is we're testing, it can be chalked up to a marketing budget. And it's not right. Exactly how it lands in our budgeting, but it could be if that's how you wanted to look at it. Even just being able to say that we're thinking about these things and talking about these things, even if they never happen, is already part of the brand. I mean, right now I'm effectively branding here as we talk by saying that this is the stuff we think about.
Right.
And that's almost as important as whether I ever buy a piece of logging land and log it, right? And so the decisions have they're sort of twofold. One is, what's the value in us exploring this? And then the more difficult decision is, if it seems like a good idea, what's the value in us actually digging in, spending a whole lot more time in making it happen and shifting some of our actual dollars in our budget to it? Are dollars from investors, and that's often where things get a little bit tricky because technically our development business is a different business. It's run as a different LLC, as many developments are, and the different owners can opt in or opt out on each project basis depending on their personal evaluation of the risk, which means that the development arms is not actually a cooperative, which is a very strategic purposeful decision.
So just each project is a separate LLC?
It is. Okay. Yeah. And that's also because often we're bringing in outside people to be partners on these LLCs, and those people are investors or just guarantor backers or whatever, or even homeowners potentially. Sometimes we're doing real estate development teaming up with other homeowners. And that's been some of the innovation too, is let's do non-traditional development projects that can reduce costs for buyers by mixing our understanding of the skill sets of combining investors with homeowners, with bankers and our own cash and just neighbors who want to invest, and you know, sort of really understanding the intricacies of each piece has allowed us to do that. But in terms of the actual decisions, once we decide we want to actually push something, it's really got to work its way through how it's going to impact the business itself on each level, the architecture, the construction, and the development arm. And the reason I say the investment side is often the tricky one is if we don't put the money into real estate development, which we know can make us some returns, as we've proven, then we're pulling it out to put it into probably a far riskier endeavor. Those conversations are had between the co-owners and it's really a matter of navigating it as a team. And we've gotten pretty good. We have a whole sort of rule set about what consensus decision making is, and how it's done. And I think it is an important role to run as a facilitator, which I am generally facilitating our meetings and not just thinking that the meeting's going to run itself, but preparing for a meeting and in preparing for the meeting, try to understand where we think people are going to end up and anticipate that so that we can actually continue the conversation instead of having meetings just be updates on where things are. The value of having people together is to really think through what the true impacts on the business would be. And so just utilizing the time we have together, which is in a business that has so many moving parts as ours, it's not common that we can all sit down and have those meetings, but we set them aside. You have to schedule them in and we get through it. So I think I answered your question.
Yes. Yeah. But it also, there is a document, right? There is a document that says, this is how we do it. You know, how we're going to have these meetings. This is how we're going to have these decisions made. It's a corporation, right? So you have a corporate documents, but then you probably also have partnership documents as well that says this is how the partnerships are set up and this is how we run the company, right?
Yeah. So a whole lot of paperwork, really. Yeah. I mean, and that's what the couple years transition was us developing our bylaws as a cooperative. We are technically a C corp operating as a cooperative. Which means we can file our taxes as a cooperative, which is a whole other topic for another podcast. But then we also have our operating agreement. And then in addition to that, we just have some general rules and guidelines about how we operate as a team, which, you know, they don't come up that often, but it was something that was written together so that we can all agree on what consensus really means. Consensus is something that is very often misunderstood.
Yeah.
And people think that it means everyone has to agree, and that's not the case. It means that everyone has to be okay with moving forward with the same conclusion. And we have detailed out what that means, what is the actual language we can use. And it's not rote. It's not like you pick answer A, B, C, or D, right. but it's a good reference point, I think, for us. And then we just have a very important document for us, one of the ones I use most, is just our minutes. We have a running digital minutes, which is anytime anyone has a meeting in the business, you put the agenda in and then the notes go within the agenda. And that's where our decisions are tracked, which effectively it becomes our annual report when you need to report what decisions were made and that budgets were approved. It's all just there and we don't have to do anything else.
What tool are you using for that?
So all of our systems are run through Google Docs.
So the whole corporation basically is on Google Apps.
The whole thing is Google Drive, yeah. And all of our word processing and all of our spreadsheet work is done through the Google tools. Our email runs through Google. I'm a bit of a Google fan myself, so.
and I noticed, I mean, the reference to the percentage of time dedicated to experiments is also a Google template. I definitely see that. I see that you're a student of big successful companies, and because you're building one. We're talking about the infancy of a big company is really what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
You have big plans, and you are set up to achieve those big plans, and so it's really exciting.
Yeah. It's been fun, and we have got a great team of people here, which is what. I couldn't ask for anything more than that, really.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to have you come back someday and talk more about the development part of things.
Sure, yeah.
Because I know every time we talk about architect as developer, everybody's ears perk up.
Right.
And so we'll have you come back and talk more in depth about that.
Sure.
Thank you. Thank you for being here today. I appreciate you sharing your knowledge here with the Entree Architect podcast.
Absolutely. It was fun. Thanks so much for having me.
Complete show notes and a direct link to download this episode will be found at entrearchitect.com/episode130. And if you haven't yet gained access to our digital course, Profit for Small Firm Architects, what are you waiting for? It will show you step by step how to structure a profitable architecture firm. And it's free. To download this course right now, go to entrearchitect.com/free course. My name is Mark Arlepage. And I am an entrepreneur architect, and I encourage you to build a better business so you can be a better architect. Love, learn, and share what you know. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and this sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.